Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Caregiver and Physician Conversations, sponsored by eCareDiary.com. I'm your host, Marjorie Pabst. Today, I am joined by Dr. Barry Jacobs, whose book, The Emotional Survival Guide for Caregivers, Looking After Yourself and Your Family While Helping an Aging Parent, is absolutely appropriate for this month, National Caregivers Month. This book chronicles the emotional ups and downs of caregiving while providing very specific tools and strategies for surviving and thriving in your caregiver role. I'm also delighted that Dr. Jacobs has an article on my website this month. My website is mycaregivingcoach.com. If you go to the homepage, you can click on his article. I was delighted to have him as a guest contributor. Today, our topic is managing sibling relationships, an issue I hear very often as central to caregiver frustration and stress. Welcome, Dr. Barry Jacobs.
Thank you very much, Margie. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Great. You know, caregiving has certainly evolved over the past few years. And, you know, in the last, oh, say, 8 to 10 years, it's really, if you will, come into its own. What are your observations about caregiving and the evolution of awareness around caregiving?
I first started giving talks about family caregiving over 20 years ago, and at that time, the word family caregiver wasn't even in common parlance. People would talk about caretakers, or they would just define themselves as a son or a daughter. It was really the last 15 to 20 years that there's been a lot of efforts nationally to establish the term, so that when people could then identify themselves with that term, that they could then access services that are exist in the community for family caregivers. And that's the other big change. Since the year 2000, when there was the revision of the Older Americans Act, and there was the start of the National Family Caregiver Support Program through the local area agencies on aging, there is much more in the way of family caregiver support in most communities in this country, and that includes available support groups, home health aides, adult daycare programs, just a wealth of resources that exist through churches, hospitals, AAAs, as I mentioned. And I think just as a culture, we're just much more conversant with family caregiving and its challenges. Some of this has to do with the fact that our population is aging, and more people my age, I'm in my mid-50s, more people my age are caring for aging parents and talking with one another about how difficult it may be, but also what we can do to help one another.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to also share with our audience that Dr. Jacobs is a clinical psychologist, a family therapist, and certainly an author. As a clinician, he helps families cope with serious and chronic medical illness. He's an educator working as a director of behavioral sciences for the Crozer Keystone Family Medicine Residency Program in Springfield, Pennsylvania. And he is a national spokesperson on family caregiving for the American Heart Association and a member of the AARP Caregivers Advisory Panel. So if you've heard his name before, this is why. He's a very prominent individual in the area of caregiving. Dr. Jacobs, I know you also maintain a website, www.emotionalsurvivalguide.com, which we'll mention again at the end of this interview for those of you who would like to check in and find out more about Dr. Jacobs and his tips and tools. So I guess my early question here is, what needs do caregivers tend to have in the early days of caregiving, and what can physicians and their teams do in the early days to assist those needs?
I think the biggest need early on is for caregivers to identify themselves as such. Lots of times people become involved in caring for a parent or a disabled spouse Sometimes those loved ones have had a sudden medical event. Oftentimes they've had more of a slow progressive event, a progressive condition which has developed over time. And so family members step up and they're providing care for the people they love, and they don't really identify themselves as caregivers per se, and consequently don't look into caregiver support services that might help them in the work that they're doing. So identification is essential. And then I think secondly, for folks to begin to understand the lay of the land here, to understand what the specific condition or illness is that their loved one has, to understand the likely course of that illness over time, so that the caregivers can begin to think ahead in the future in terms of their loved one's changing needs. And then just some understanding of how caregiving works. The caregiving, as I always say, is not a sprint; it's a marathon, and people need to learn how to pace themselves in a way that's sustainable, so that they can do this work over time from start to finish, if in fact that's what they choose to do. So that's a lot of kind of basic orientation at the beginning to figure out this new role that they're in, and what the challenges are ahead of them. In terms of the role that physicians and other professionals can play with them, I think that education and orientation is essential. And I think the emphasis early on self-care and self-replenishment for people like those who are running a marathon, to take in whatever support, whatever replenishment exists in order to help them sustain themselves over the course. What unfortunately happens with many caregivers is they begin getting into this work and they do not want help from other people because they feel that this is something that they should do on their own. And so they reject help that's offered, and they don't reach out for help that may be available until they get into trouble, until they're starting to feel really tuckered out. And at that point, it's very difficult to put water back in the well. So physicians and others can help people with this idea of pacing, of using the supports that exist to support themselves over time, and so that they to take a long view on the challenge that they've taken upon themselves.
Yes, you're identifying this issue of identifying yourself as a caregiver is fascinating to me, as I see friends. And loved ones as well, who are now beginning to take care of someone. And I'll say something along the lines of to them, oh, you know, you're a caregiver now. And they'll say, no, I'm not a caregiver. And so this issue of self-identification, what does one do if someone says, oh, I'm just simply, you know, making meals or taking this person to the doctor, I'm not a caregiver. What does one do when faced with that, especially somebody who's a friend of a new caregiver?
I would talk with that friend about how it's wonderful that they're doing what they're doing for their loved one. And in order to enable them to do more of it over time, we have to figure out how to help them do it in as smart and as strategic a way as possible. And whether we call that caregiving or not, we still want to draw on what services exist that exist in their community to help them do that work. And as a friend, we also want to lend them a helping hand if we can with the work that they're doing. Yeah. Oftentimes, people are very humble and they also believe that families should take care of themselves and that to accept, quote unquote, handouts from others is somehow shameful. And instead, what I recommend friends do is to really praise people for the work that they're doing, but also to caution them that this is work that demands a long view, and as I said before, that pacing to in order to make it from start to finish over the course.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you for that. It is one of those hurdles. I can remember when I finally identified myself as a caregiver, and it really was a day that emotionally I felt a lot better after I decided that, in fact, I was one. And so for those of you listening out there who also have friends that are caregivers, helping other people realize that long view that Dr. Jacobs is talking about is so important. Well, let's turn to sibling relationships. It is a real problem, a thorn. It's a tough nut. And why? Let's just begin simply with a question of, well, why are sibling relationships so key to family caregiving?
Well, sibling relationships are coming up in the context of caring for an aging parent, they're key because caring for a parent who may be having Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease or just very severe arthritis, that these are, again, these are not short-term situations. These are situations which require ongoing care, usually for months and years. And so for the bulk of that care to fall on one person's shoulders means that one person is at very high risk for burning out. And so it's very important in these situations to develop a caregiving team, and that team usually consists of the adult children. The challenge here is that many of these adult children have really not worked together, perhaps ever, but certainly not in many years, perhaps decades. They grew up. They may have kept in contact with one another, maybe even had good relations, but they're living in different parts of the country, or even if they're living in the same community, they haven't had to pull together in a concerted way in order to help a parent before, or for any project for that matter. And so, you have people who have a history, and that history hopefully is a good history, but it's a history which has a hierarchy depending on birth order. There may be gender issues that girls in the family may have been socialized to approach care, giving care one way, and the boys in another way, and so all these things come to the fore when a parent gets older and needs more help, and then this group of people has to learn how to work together in a way, in an effective way for the parent's sake, and most of them don't have the vocabulary to even begin talking about it with one another.
Yes. What does a good sibling relationship look like, and what does a bad one look like?
I think a good sibling relationship is one in which the siblings feel like they have each other's back. That it doesn't necessarily mean that each of the siblings are going to do exactly the same amount of care, because in reality that almost never happens. The bulk of the care almost always falls on one of the children's shoulders. But for all the siblings to feel that they're contributing in some form or fashion, and for all siblings to feel that the others are there to support them and to commiserate with them if need be, but that for them to stand shoulder to shoulder provides the kind of support that helps sustain people over time. A bad sibling relationship is one in which the other siblings simply don't care. They say things like, I've never had a good relationship with Dad. I don't want to step up and help them now. Therefore, I don't want to help you in your efforts to help Dad. Where siblings are extremely critical of one another, where there's a lot of blaming, and where siblings, unfortunately, rather than pulling together, they're pulling in different directions, and the conflict is exacerbating the stress that everybody's feeling. And unfortunately, in my experience as a psychologist, I see all too often that these relationships among adult children are characterized by pulling apart, criticism, hurt feelings, anger, recrimination. And that makes the caregiving so much harder over time.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if there's someone out there listening today who is the primary caregiver and has siblings who are in various stages of not wanting to get along, what are some successful tools that you've seen caregivers employ that helped rally even their siblings who were not wanting to go along with everyone? What might be some techniques that you've seen used?
Sure. So for the caregiver, the primary caregiver, in reaching out to the siblings for help, my advice, first of all, would be for them to say, please help out for Dad's sake. but instead to say, please help out for my sake, because mm-hmm. I need the help, and to personalize it in that way. And I would even go further and to make it clear that if the sibling steps up and helps, then the caregiver will be eternally grateful for them, and that will in fact improve their relationship. But by the same token, if the sibling decides not to help, turns their back on the situation, then that is going to have a negative impact long term on the relationship between those two siblings. So I really do think that the choices that people make at these times matter long after the parent has died. That people remember who is there for one another in the hour of need. And so I want everybody to be put on notice that the stakes are high here, and that that everyone is observing the choices that everyone else in the family is making. So that's one one step. The other step is I think that there needs to be ongoing communication about what the parents' condition is and what the parents' needs are, and that means for the caregiving child to set up some sort of communication system, maybe an email system where every one of the siblings in the group is getting the same medical information, the same insurance information, that everybody is kind of on an equal footing in terms of the information they have to work with, in the hopes that people will come to a common view of what the parent is going through and what the caregiving demands are. Oftentimes, one of the biggest barriers to pulling siblings together is that within any given sibling group, there are some people who will say, yes, Dad has dementia, and then there are other people who will say, well, Dad was always forgetful. He doesn't have dementia. And then there's conflict among siblings just about what's going on. So through the sharing information, the idea is to develop greater consensus, and that it's on the basis of that consensus that some sort of caregiving plan can be developed. And then finally, I think it's very important for the caregiving child, the primary caregiver, to have ongoing meetings, not just provide information, but to actually have meetings either in person or via some sort of conference call, where the siblings are talking together about what's happening and talking about the parents' needs, but also talking about their own respective life situations, and trying to find ways of seeing who's willing and available and cobbling together some kind of plan that everyone agrees on, and that everybody appreciates the contribution that the other person is making, and that this is a process that should be repeated every 3 months, in my opinion. Sometimes this is a process that's greatly aided by having an outside facilitator, a pastor, a mental health professional, a trusted family friend, somebody who could come in and facilitate or even referee if need be, but to try to foster communication among these siblings. Because, as I said before, these are folks who haven't talked in this kind of serious way and try to pull together in a concerted fashion maybe ever before.
Yeah, all very good points. With respect to the meeting, would you say that numbers make a difference? So, for example, if there are more than, say, four siblings, let's just say, pull that out of the hat, is a facilitator a better thing as the numbers of a family grow?
I think so.
Or is that not an issue?
Yeah. Well, no. I think that the larger the sibling group, the more helpful it would be to have a facilitator just to kind of keep everybody on track, to keep the number of digressions to a minimum, to make sure everybody has had an opportunity to express themselves. Because as you're suggesting, the larger the group, often the more chaos in the room. Mm-hmm. So to have somebody there to ensure that the conversation flows smoothly and that at the end everybody is reasonably satisfied that they've been heard and with the result that's been arrived at.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's the most important thing is that everybody gets heard, even though everybody thinks Uncle Harry or so-and-so is dysfunctional, that Uncle Harry still gets to have his say at this family meeting.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody who comes to a family meeting, I assume, has some sort of vested interest in the parents' well-being. That everybody, just by dint of the fact that they come to the meeting and participate, means that they care, and that they consequently deserve to be able to voice their opinion, even if their opinion is not, that of the consensus, and even if they may not have been intimately involved with the parent for some time, everyone has the right to share their thoughts about what would be best, and then the group as a whole has to weigh all those thoughts and recommendations in pulling together a plan.
I've seen it as a very effective tool if, in fact, the parent or loved one who is ill, if that person can speak up and say what they want, that's often a very effective tiebreaker. In other words, you see siblings and the primary caregiver arguing about, well, what is it we need to do for mother? Well, if mother says, look, this is what I want, it's a very effective way to end some of that chaos in a family meeting.
I think if the parent is willing and able and competent, then I think it's wonderful to have them there at the meeting. I mean, yes, as you say, that parent can be a tiebreaker in the event of some disagreement among the siblings. Oftentimes, in the instance where a parent has dementia, it's not possible to have the parent involved
right.
in the discussion. But I think if the parent is able, by all means, invite him or her to the meeting.
Yes. Great. And what about, sometimes these family meetings also are about not only patient care, but they're about legal issues, financial issues. What do you recommend to families? That they have separate meetings about issues like that, apart from the issues around patient care? Would you recommend that each meeting have a specific purpose?
I think it's pretty hard to pull people together, even on a quarterly basis, because all of us live such busy lives. And I think it's very difficult to separate the financial issues from the care issues, the medical decision making, et cetera. And so, what I have seen is all these issues tend to get lumped together and have to get sorted out in the same meeting. In instances where siblings are only focused on, the care, just the logistics of care, who's going to drive dad to physical therapy and who's going to pick up his medicine and, who's going to tuck him in at night, that may not take into account, where the money is and who's paying for this. And that has to be discussed. That's an issue that has to be put on the table because it's an issue that may really shape the caregiving as it goes forward. And it's also an issue that most of the siblings are thinking about in one way or another anyhow. So I wouldn't divide the meetings up into a financial meeting and a legal meeting or in a care logistics meeting. I think it's all intertwined.
Great. Okay. And I want to go back to an answer you gave us earlier about what primary caregivers can do. I thought it was so resonant with me as I was listening to you that it's so important that people realize that the choices are critical that they're making at this moment. At this point in their family history. And that is so true. And I'm wondering should the primary caregiver make that point? Should they bring out maybe family scrapbooks? I don't know. How can a family caregiver put a positive twist on the fact that what's happening at meetings, what's happening during this critical point in their family, are it's really important as to how they move forward and the kind of memories, either positive or negative, that they make.
Speaking as a psychologist again, it's easy for me to say to a family as a kind of outside observer that what you do now, the kind of choices you make, and how you treat one another will be remembered forever after. It's a little more difficult for a primary caregiver to say it, but I think the point that needs to be made is that in the histories of families, in the lives of family members, people remember certain incidents better than others. You know, people remember who was at the wedding and who wasn't there, you know, who came to the funeral, who didn't come, and people remember who was there during this tough challenge of caring for an aging parent and who simply, you know, sat on the sidelines. And so for the primary caregiver to say, you know, that this is a tough time in the life of her family, and you know, if you can step up and help, this is going to matter tremendously, and really, that you know, afterglow will last for many years. And so I you know, to somehow underscore just how important this time is in the life of the family, it you know, puts everybody on notice that they are being observed, and their decisions are being either, you know, praised or in some cases denounced.
Yes. And maybe even as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, if I were in the midst of something like this, maybe pulling out some family photos of times that were happier, and to remind people that, you know, we have a strong family, and at its core, it's a happy family.
I think that's a great idea. I think what also often happens is that people think back to when they were kids and their parents were taking care of the grandparent generation, and what it was like for their grandparents, for their parents to be the caregivers at that time. And now it's, you know, 20 or 30 years later, and the shoe is on the other foot, and the you know, this you know, middle-aged generation is now taking care of their aging parents, and they have the lessons from what came before, but the world is also a different place, and circumstances may be very, very different, and so they have to reinvent this. But people often make reference to what it was like to take care of grandma when she had to go to the nursing home years ago. So within every family there are family legacies of caregiving that families can draw upon.
Right. Well, that's all of those things are really, really important, and I really love your tips about reaching out for help and saying help for my sake. I mean, what an important distinction to make. Help for my sake as a caregiver. To have meetings and to organize those meetings. I would even say call meetings enough ahead of time so it's more possible that everyone can make that meeting, either on the phone or in person. And then this whole issue of ongoing communications and finding a system for doing that. I have to add that the sponsor of this show, ecarediary.com, actually one of the things they do online is they do have a system for people tracking medications and changes in treatment for loved ones. So that's something our listeners may be aware of, but if you're not, please check into that. What haven't I asked about sibling relationships that you think I might should have asked in our moments remaining here, Doctor?
Well, Margie, what I would say is that in my book, The Emotional Survival Guide for Caregivers, I tell a fictional story of two sisters in their 50s who are caring for their mother, 80-year-old mother who has metastatic cancer. But what I try to bring out in the book is that every child in the family, every adult child, has her own personality and her own talents, and that they're not identical. And so the caregiving plan has to take into account what each person can bring to the effort. Hopefully siblings' talents and personalities complement one another, and that way, you know, the team works in a more seamless way. And that, I think, is you know, when people have had that experience, at the end of the day, it really does make for better sibling relationships than they have ever existed before. And then people look back and say, you know, we did this together, and I'm really glad that I had you working with me side by side.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. And to find the complementary things and personalities, I love that. That's great. We can find your book on your website. I know that. And it's, again, the survival...
The emotional survival guide for caregivers looking after an aging parent and your family. I'm blowing the title of my own book. I want to just say the emotional survival guide for caregivers, and you can find it on Amazon.com.
Okay, that's just wonderful. Thanks again so much, Dr. Barry Jacobs. Whenever you come on the show, it's a delight, and you always give us such great things to think about. Take care to our viewers, or our listeners, I should say, and we appreciate your joining us this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.